TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Technology and Globalization. Manufactured News and Altered Thinking. The global advertising budget is now approaching $1 billion per day. Public relations firms play a major role in forming public opinion, not just on products they sell, but even on news. John Stauber is one of the country's leading critics on the role of corporate advertising and public relations. He's the editor of the publication PR Watch, published by the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin, where he is the executive director. He begins by quoting the work of the Australian sociologist Alex Carey, who set out to prove that the American people are the most propagandized people on Earth. John Stauber.
Propaganda is a dirty word, and you know we're taught that we don't have propaganda, that that's out of Hitler's Germany or Stalin's Russia. But in fact, as Alex Carey pointed out, we are the most propagandized people in history. And he wrote that the 20th century has been marked by three great developments: the rise of democracy and democracy movements around the world, the rise of corporate power, and the rise of corporate propaganda to protect corporate power against democracy. Carey went on to say that in countries like the United States or Australia, corporate propaganda is waged through advertising, commercial marketing, and especially public relations. And public relations is invisible. The best propaganda is always invisible, and PR only works if it's invisible. Seven giant corporations own and control 50% of everything you see, hear, and read in a given day. And in fact, what makes those media corporations go? It's advertising. I think the global advertising budget is now approaching something like $1 billion a day, just dumped into the media. And of course, what is the media all about? Only one thing: to deliver an audience to advertisers so that public relations and advertising can manipulate what we see, hear, think, and buy. When we see an ad, hopefully we think, well, that's an advertisement. Hopefully something clicks on and says somebody spent an awful lot of money developing that message, packaging it, using sex or fear or whatever grabs us emotionally to get us to buy that toothpaste or vote for that candidate. But then we get to the news, and we think, well, here's something we can trust. After all, it's the news. Some journalist went out investigating. Apparently this audience can't trust it. You know, it's the news. We have a free press. We have a First Amendment. We have all these reporters rushing all around, digging out what's important, getting it in front of us. Well, you know, that's nice if it were true. But unfortunately, the academics who study the news tell us that 40 to 60% or more of what we see, hear, and read as news every day is public relations. It's propaganda. It's been put there by a PR campaign. If it's local TV news, it might be a fake news story. One of the literally thousands of video news releases that look like news stories, in fact, they're very well-produced news stories by journalists who no longer work in journalism, who now work for the PR industry and are preparing these stories on behalf of their Fortune 500 clients. Every TV news director in the country gets access to these every single day through the web. They've got their little code and password. They can go in and pull them off, and through satellites. And the TV news directors air these stories as news. It's a big, dirty secret. And the PR people say, hey, don't blame us. We're the propagandists. Blame the news directors. And in fact, they're absolutely right. Blame the news directors.
That was John Stauber. He edits and writes for the quarterly news magazine PR Watch. In collaboration with PR Watch editor Sheldon Rampton, he has co-authored three books: Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Mad Cow USA, Could the Nightmare Happen Here?, and Trust Us, We're the Experts, How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future. Next up is the topic of the impact of computers. Chad Bowers is currently adjunct professor of environmental studies at the University of Oregon. He says that computers alter our way of thinking. They suppress certain aspects of our humanity and consciousness while amplifying others. What are these changes? Are we aware of them? And how are they connected to the technological revolution that has been changing us and the world for well over 100 years? Chet Bowers.
But first I want to focus on the point Jerry makes in the introduction, that is, how we can understand computers as creating a particular form of consciousness, a particular form of subjectivity. And so when we look at this, we need to ask, how is this form of consciousness, this mindset, how is it similar to the mindset that was required by the Industrial Revolution? And to what extent are we in the digital phase of the Industrial Revolution, and thus moving away from what I would call eco-justice, where there's an emphasis on the intergenerational aspects of community life that reduce the need to be consumers? Computers reinforce those aspects of the mindset that is oriented towards the industrial model of production and consumption that is now being globalized. And if my analysis is correct, then it's problematic to say that computers should be available to students at a certain age. I think we have to look at the broader question and ask, to what extent do computers undermine the forms of knowledge that are basic, the forms of relationships that are basic to community? And there's an interesting connection between what I call eco-justice, or educating for community, and what universities have relegated to low status. That is, they've left it out of the curriculum. And what they've left in the university curriculum are those patterns of thought that are very much part of the mindset reinforced by computers. What is it that the Industrial Revolution required, and how are those thought patterns similar to what are reinforced by the inherent nature of the technology, that is, of the computer? Well, first of all, the Industrial Revolution depended upon encoding knowledge in print, which is a decontextualized approach to encoding information. And print, or literacy, was a very powerful metaphor for determining who was advanced and who was backward. Illiteracy meant that you were primitive and we had nothing to learn from them. So the Industrial Revolution required print. Computers require print. I know there's a difference in that the electronic version of print is interactive and can be communicated globally in a way in which books cannot be communicated, okay? So let's not fight over that issue. But the commonality is print, decontextualized. Print fosters individualism. It enhances sight over the other senses. Another aspect of the Industrial Revolution, which we also find inherent in computers, is the notion that we should take an experimental approach to knowledge and values. Another aspect of the Industrial Revolution was the emphasis on thinking of life processes in mechanistic terms. There was a program on nature just the other day where they were talking about survival mechanisms of various animals, and they were referring to the brains of various organisms as computers. And I could just take you through Western history from Kepler down to the present on how we've used mechanism as a schema for making sense of things. And this is very prominent in terms of computers, in terms of how we're thinking about the brain and what we think intelligence is. Another aspect of the Industrial Revolution, which was absolutely essential to its messianic drive to colonize the world, first as a source of resources, but now as market, is the notion that language is a conduit. It's a sender-receiver model. And that's absolutely essential for maintaining the notion that data is objective and that information is objective. The truth is, and I'm using that word in a well-founded way because there's a huge literature to support it, that language is metaphorical and encodes the mythopoetic narratives of cultural groups, and these mythopoetic metaphors, or what I call root metaphors, organize our thought process for us. These root metaphors include anthropocentrism, mechanism, individualism, progress, patriarchy, and the list goes. Now evolution is reemerging as a meta-schemata, an aspect of our language that organizes our thought process as we think within that language. There goes the notion of the autonomous individual. But that is also one of the myths that is promoted in terms of computers. That is, that the experience of sitting in front of a screen and moving the cursor and surfing the internet, that you are an autonomous individual. Nothing could be further from the truth if we understand how language organizes the thought process and carries forward earlier forms of intelligence. How we're embedded in these very complex ecology of language systems, which are in turn embedded in natural systems. Now, there's another aspect of computers that's reinforced, and that is a particular sense of temporality. And in order to understand this, you really have to look at other cultures where the experience of the past and the future are part of the present. In terms of computers, it reinforces a subjective experience where the individual decides, does the past have any relevance and does the future have any meaning? Am I alone? Am I making these autonomous choices? And I think it reinforces that. That, by the way, that sense of being disconnected is absolutely essential for a consumer-oriented culture. One of the dominant characteristics of the industrial era is that the Industrial Revolution involved the commoditization of land, of labor, but now every aspect of life is fair game as a niche market where instead of having personal skills and relationships, you can buy a product or a relationship or expert knowledge or whatever. So I want to say that one of the characteristics of computers is that it commoditizes thought and communication. To think now, we have to have a computer, we have to have the internet services, we have to be tied into that economy, or we're backward. Okay, now let me get back on track here. What cannot be digitized are the low status forms of knowledge that are the basis of self-sufficient communities, the basis of cultural diversity, and the basis of renewing intergenerational knowledge of the limits and possibilities of a bioregion. Universities determine what constitutes high status knowledge and what constitutes low status knowledge by virtue of what's left out of the curriculum. I think the following characteristics of low status knowledge, which cannot be digitized, are also the patterns that universities ignore. I make a case that the universities are really part of the ecological crisis. Now, what is it that you cannot do through a computer? You cannot do face-to-face communication through a computer. What are the other forms of intergenerational knowledge that have to do with self-sufficient communities that have a smaller ecological footprint because they involve people learning from each other, being mutually interdependent, and so on? Well, these include, these intergenerational forms of knowledge that you cannot digitize include elder knowledge. You cannot digitize mentoring. That's face-to-face, intergenerational, and very complex and very important in terms of maintaining community. You cannot digitize narratives. Narratives in the sense of face-to-face as part of community cannot be digitized. It becomes abstract. You can't digitize ceremonies. You cannot digitize the patterns of mutual aid that characterize different cultural groups. And you cannot digitize all the non-commodified activities, relationships, and skills that make up a community, from how do you do gardening to how do you do various other kinds of activities, including the arts, such as theater or writing poetry or learning to play an instrument and so on. That cannot be digitized. You can have instructions, but mentoring involves the shaping of a personality, of skill, of a relationship. I think that the dominant characteristics of high status knowledge correspond to the dominant characteristics of what can be amplified by the inherent nature of computers. Print, a conduit view of language, individualism, the notion that change is linear and progressive, the commodification. Where are the scientists now who at one time had some rather ideal notions about not commoditizing their research? Well, let me stop at that point. Thank you.
That was Chet Bowers. He teaches environmental studies at the University of Oregon and is the author of 11 books, including The Cultural Dimensions of Educational Computing, Understanding the Non-Neutrality of Technology, and Let Them Eat Data, How Computers Affect Education, Cultural Diversity, and the Prospects of Ecological Sustainability. Jane Healy is an educational psychologist and professional educator for more than 35 years. In her latest book, Failure to Connect, she describes how computers affect children's minds and what we can do about it. She invites parents and teachers to question the wisdom of decisions that are being made at the highest level of government and education. They are advocating computer technology in education as an end in itself, outside of a more whole and comprehensive approach to learning and intelligence overall. Jane Healy.
I am here to represent the needs and the developmental process of children. When I was writing Failure to Connect, in which I examine not only what is happening in the state of technology in schools today and in homes with kids, but also attempt to draw some relationships between what we know about neurophysical, neurochemical development, and, in other words, the development of the brain, and what may be happening to children as a result of using these powerful new media. When I was in the process of collecting my research, I went and talked to many people and I watched many kids using computers in schools and in homes. Near the beginning of my expedition, I met a superintendent from Long Island who said to me, "You know, Jane," he said, "I feel as if we're on this boat. We're going down a river, we don't know where we're going, and we don't know why we're going there, but we're all jumping on the boat because we are afraid we're going to be left behind." And I am sorry to say that that characterized a great deal of the conversation I heard from educators who claimed that it was the parents that were putting on the pressure. The parents claimed that their children were going to be left behind if they didn't have computers when they were just out of the cradle or possibly even in it. Of course, all of this goes back to an extraordinary advertising campaign that has attempted to convince the already gullible American public that technology is what is needed to improve not only upon childhood, but also upon our modes of parenting and teaching young children. This, of course, is balderdash. Let me give you an example of what I saw when I went out into schools, and this particular example I select because it's from this city, in what is known as a disadvantaged neighborhood in every sense, except that this school had been gifted with enough technology to put IBM into business, or at least to keep them in business for some period of time. And they had a computer lab, and what I saw when I entered the room was 30 kids lined up at a bank of 30 computers, Actually, the way they were positioned was unsafe because the children were essentially staring into the backs of other kids' machines, and the lighting was flickering. It was fluorescent lighting, and we know that there are physical hazards. These are physical hazards that would not be allowed in the adult workplace. Anyhow, I stood behind a young man who was clearly there for remedial purposes. He was in the fifth grade, and he was solving some math problems, and then you get to blast aliens for a while. Raul selected a few easy addition problems. We're talking 2 plus 3, 5 plus 1. Solved them almost instantly, and as he got his reward, a smile beamed across his face, and he blasted aliens for approximately 5 minutes, at which point he was electronically corralled back into a couple more math problems, and the same thing happened for an hour. And my teacher's soul just curled up and cringed at the thought of that perfect time wasted to do something with this child before it was too late. It wasn't going to happen because there was one teacher in this entire room, and she spent almost the entire time fixing a computer that had broken. So, anyhow, what are we teaching Raul about all this? Well, we're basically teaching him what much of this software, which is called, by the way, you may know, edutainment, which is certainly takes the prize for oxymorons. We're teaching him basically to choose easy problems because he gets his reward sooner. We're teaching him the only reason to do math is so he can get mindless fun as a reward. Basically, we are teaching Raul to behave as a droid. And I would contend to you that today's children, surrounded by electronic toys and electronic stimuli that potentially dull their consciousness, their brains, their social-emotional development, and even their very development of themselves, I would contend to you that we are in danger of raising a generation of droids that can't think for themselves and really don't have a sense of anything inside their own heads except the images, cute though they may be, that come to them from media. And yeah, now I'm going to really surprise you. I still have hopes for this technology. You see, I am a closet techie. So I'd say we have an extraordinary tension here between the potential of what can be done with these young growing minds and what is actually happening as a function, no doubt, of more advertising money and commercialism than just about anything else. Just to summarize very briefly, there are a number of developmental concerns, and the first of these is what age should children be using, especially these computer products. And my contention is that they do not belong on computers until at least age 7. And that to this group, that may not sound like an extreme statement. Trust me, in today's culture in the United States, to say that a child shouldn't be on a computer until age 7 is enough to have people practically string you up in the public square as a witch. The developmental issues that I believe need to be seriously addressed with questions asked before we move strongly into adding any more technologies into children's lives. First of all are the physical risks of computer exposure, which can involve vision, postural, musculoskeletal, and repetitive stress type issues. Not to mention the lack of exercise and the deprivation of the normal neurochemical stimulus that comes from children's outdoor physical play and three-dimensional, and not to mention bilateral. And if you think of a kid with a mouse, it's not only not whole body, but it's very unilateral. And the brain depends, particularly in young ages, on bilateral movement, such as catching a ball, climbing a tree, you know, building something. What will happen to kids who don't get this? We have children going into physical therapists now at 7 and 8 who are bright kids, and the therapists say they're developmentally retarded to about the level of 3 and 4 in physical movement and coordination. And those are the foundations of higher cognitive processes. And then we add things such as attention, motivation, problem solving, ideation, the ability to conceive an idea in your own mind and get a picture there without having some darling little flashy garish icon pushed into your consciousness every day. I mean, our children can't make pictures in their minds because their images have been brought to them. And this shows up in school constantly, in reading comprehension problems, in art class, you name it, it shows up. So we have all of that, and then on top of that, we have all the social-emotional issues. Foremost among these are issues of values, the commercialism that is being pushed into our kids' lives every day. These children have been so commercialized that they are becoming cynical before they have an opportunity to learn to be critical. And the only hope here, and there is a lot of hope for the human race, because children are resilient and they are smart, even if we try to make them into droids, they may survive, is that they're going to get so cynical about all of this that they're going to turn on the very advertisers and the very industries that have made them this way. And I think it's happening. Thank you.
That was Jane Healy, a psychologist and educator. She's the author of Failure to Connect: How Computers Affect Children's Minds, and the landmark book, Endangered Minds, Why Kids Can't Think and What to Do About It. I hope you have a pen handy for more information. You can find links to the websites of the organizations mentioned today on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. You can get a copy of today's program with John Stauber, Chet Bowers, and Jane Healy on Manufactured News and Altered Thinking for $12. TUC Radio is listener-supported. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gelaiden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.